This is Free Thought Radio with co-hosts Dan Barker and Annie Laurie Gaylor. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews.
Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell below us. Above us, only sky.
Are you happy heretics? I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor, and this is Free Thought Radio.
And I'm Dan Barker, your friendly neighborhood atheist. Free Thought Radio is the weekly production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, a national organization working to keep state and church separate, a membership organization, and we hope someday you will join us. We also work to educate the public about those of us who do not believe.
And, of course, we're very sad about the demise of Air America Radio, which went off the air formally last Monday, and Free Thought Radio had been nationally distributed by them and streamed weekends over Air America since the fall of 2008. So we do hope to make arrangements over the next few months to get Free Thought Radio back on the air in many cities.
And this is the weekend of January 30th and 31st, 2010. For now, we are pleased to report that Free Thought Radio is broadcasting on Anchorage, KUDOAM, Anchorage, Alaska, in Atlanta on, what is that, Green 1640? Is that what it says? Green 1640, and in Grand Rapids, Michigan, which is WPRR 1680 AM. We hope in the next few weeks to report that we're back on the air in many more of the other cities that used to carry Free Thought Radio on Air America.
And of course, Free Thought Radio will continue podcasting as well.
Our guest today, who will join Free Thought Radio for the second half of the show, will be Jerry Coyne. He's the author of the book, Why Evolution is True. It's a 2009 book. It's just coming out in paperback. Professor Coyne is professor in the Department of Ecology and Evolution at the University of Chicago, where he specializes in evolutionary genetics.
And Professor Coyne will be one of several guests over the next month who will be joining us in part to talk about evolution and Charles Darwin, since February 9th. Upcoming will mark the 201st anniversary of Darwin's birth. We'll also be speaking next week with Richard Dawkins, so don't miss that show.
It's been a while since Richard Dawkins has been on our show. Of course, his new book on evolution is called The Greatest Show on Earth.
And later in February, we'll talk with Freedom From Religion Foundation officer James Kors about the war against evolution and from his perspective as a professor of agronomy about why this war on evolution hurts students and ultimately our nation.
And if you're listening right here in Madison, Wisconsin, look for us at the Freedom From Religion Foundation table before the distinguished lecture begins at the University of Wisconsin Memorial Union, the lecture given by Ayan Hirsi Ali, next Tuesday, February the 2nd at 7:30 p.m. And by the way, you need tickets for that series, so if you just show up, you can wait on standby, but you're not assured seating.
The Freedom From Religion Foundation is co-sponsoring that lecture by Ayan Hirsi Ali. Of course, she is the author of the very eloquent book, Infidel, her account of growing up in Somalia as a woman who leaves not only the country, but leaves her religion, is an outspoken atheist, and now has to live in fear of retribution.
I'm looking forward to that. It was a wonderful book. Now we're going to turn to some news. First, we want to report non-belief relief for Haiti.
The day after the Haitian earthquake, the foundation made a $1,000 contribution to Doctors Without Borders, which already had people there working. Is a highly rated charity and is, of course, totally secular. And we invited our members to contribute to secular charities. Many of them are helping.
Last week, the foundation joined up with Non-Believers Giving Aid Support for the Haiti Tragedy and Beyond. This is a brand new website hosted by the Richard Dawkins Foundation for Reason and Science.
But for short, we're calling it Non-Belief Relief, for Haiti, which I think is...
That's cute. Non-belief relief.
And 100% of donations will go to the Charitable Doctors Without Borders and International Red Cross. PayPal has agreed to waive all fees on Haiti or Haiti, depending on how you pronounce that, related donations through February 11th. So you can give directly, of course, but this makes it very easy for non-believers to give. And as Richard Dawkins notes, when donating via non-believers giving aid, you are helping to counter the scandalous myth that only the religious care about their fellow humans. These donations are passed on to aid organizations that do not have religious affiliations. You can go to the FFRF website. The homepage has our non-belief relief for Haiti emblem right there at the website. You can link on it. It will take you to the proper pages.
Well, actually, if you're not tithing or giving money to a religious organization, you have a little more cash than religious people for things like real charity. And as Dawkins also puts it at the Non-Believers Giving Aid Support for the Haiti Tragedy and Beyond website, he says, the myth that it is only the religious who truly care is sustained largely by the fact that they tend to donate not as individuals, but through their churches. Non-believers, by contrast, give as individuals. We have no church through which to give collectively, no church to rack up statistics of competitive generosity. Non-believers giving aid is not a church, that's putting it mildly, but it does provide an easy conduit for the non-religious to help those in desperate need, whilst simultaneously giving the lie to the canard that you need God to be good.
And that brings us to the wonderful op-ed in the New York Times last Sunday, and maybe you caught it. Unfortunately, we were not able to make contact with its author to book him for this show, but it's a lovely piece of writing and logic. It's addressing Pat Robertson's remarks about Haiti, the idea of theodicy, or as I call it, theoidiocy. We talked about that briefly 2 weeks ago on Free Thought Radio, and we do want to share it over the air.
Are you going to read it for us?
I am, because you have a cold. Normally, right. I'd ask you to.
You can save my voice. Don't pray for me.
It's called Between God and a Hard Place, and this is James Wood, who's also a novelist who has written, let me see what the name of his book is, a very fascinating sounding book, which we have to get, The Book Against God. He's a staff writer at The New Yorker, and we will try to book him for a future show. But he wrote on the January 23rd New York Times, in the 18th century, the genre of earthquake sermon was good business. Two small shocks in London in 1750 sent the preachers to their pulpits and pamphlets. The Bishop of London blamed Londoners' lewd behavior. The Bishop of Oxford argued that God had woven into his grand design certain incidents to alarm us and shake us out of our sin. In Bloomsbury, the Reverend Dr. William Stukeley preached that earthquakes are favored by God as the ultimate sign of his wrathful intervention. 5 years later, when Lisbon was all but demolished by an enormous earthquake, the unholy refrain was heard again. One preacher even argued that the people of Lisbon had been relatively fortunate, for God had spared more people than he had killed. It was the Lisbon earthquake that prompted Voltaire to attack Leibniz's metaphysical optimism, in which all is for the best in the best of all possible worlds. Theodicy, which is the justification of God's good government of the world in the face of evil and pain, was suddenly harder to practice. But the preachers kept at it. There is no divine visitation which is likely to have so general an influence upon sinners as an earthquake, wrote the founder of Methodism, John Wesley, in 1777. Have we made much of an advance on this appalling discourse? Our own earthquake sermonizer, the evangelist Pat Robertson, delivered an instantly notorious defense of the calamity in Haiti. This was classic theodicy. First, good comes out of suffering. This event, said Mr. Robertson, is a blessing in disguise because it might generate a huge rebuilding program. Second, the Haitians deserve the suffering. According to Mr. Robertson, when the Haitians were throwing off the tyranny of the French, they swore a pact to the devil. They said, we will serve you if you will get us free from the French. So the devil said, okay, it's a deal, and they kicked the French out. The Haitians revolted and got themselves free, but ever since they have been cursed by one thing after another, unquote. The Dominican Republic, he said, had done quite well and had lots of tourist resorts and that kind of thing, but not Haiti. This repellent cruelty manages the extraordinary trick of combining hellfire evangelism with neocolonialist complacency, in which the Haitians are blamed not only for their sinfulness, but also for the hubris of their political rebellion. 18th century preachers at least tended to include themselves in the charge of general sinfulness and God's inevitable reckoning. Mr. Robertson sounds rather pleased with his own outwitting of such reckoning, as if the convenient blessing of being a God-fearing American has saved him from such pestilence. He is presumably on the other side of the sin line, safe in some Dominican resort. We should expect nothing less from the man who blamed legal abortion for Hurricane Katrina, but even when intentions are the opposite of Mr. Robertson's and in a completely secular context, theological language has a way of hanging around earthquakes. In his speech after the catastrophe, President Obama movingly invoked, quote, our common humanity, unquote, and said that, quote, we stand in solidarity with our neighbors to the south, knowing that but for the grace of God, there we go, unquote. And there was God once again. Awkwardly, the literal meaning of Mr. Obama's phrase is not so much, not so far from Pat Robertson's hatefulness. Who, after all, would want to worship the kind of God whose grace protects Americans from Asian horrors? The president was merely uttering an idiomatic version of the kind of thing you hear from survivors whenever a disaster strikes. God must have been watching out for me. It's a miracle I survived, whereby those who died were presumably not being watched out for. That President Obama did not really mean this, he clearly did not, is telling insofar as it suggests how the theological language of punishment and mercy lives on unconsciously, well after the actual theology has been discarded. Or has it? If the president simply meant that most of us have been, so far, luckier than Haitians, why didn't he say that? Perhaps, as a Christian, he does not want to believe that he subscribes to such a non-providential category as luck, or to the turn of fate's wheel, which is really a pagan notion. Besides, to talk of luck or fortune in the face of a disaster seems flippant and belittling to those who have been savaged by such bad luck. A toothache is bad luck. An earthquake is somehow theological. The only people who seem to have the right to invoke God at the moment are the Haitians themselves, who beseech his help amidst dreadful pain. They too, alas, appear to wander the wasteland of theodicy. News reports have described some Haitians giving voice to a worldview uncomfortably close to Pat Robertson's, in which a vengeful God has been meting out justified retribution. I blame man. God gave us nature, and we Haitians and our governments abuse the land. You cannot get away without consequences, one man told the Times last week. Others sound like a more frankly theological President Obama. A 27-year-old survivor, Mondesir Ramon, was quoted thus, we have survived by the grace of God. Bishop Eric Toussaint, standing near his damaged cathedral, said something similar. Why give thanks to God? Because we are here. What happened is the will of God. We are in the hands of God now. A survivor's gratitude is combined with theological fatalism. This response is entirely understandable, uttered in a ruined landscape beyond the experience of most of us, and a likely source of pastoral comfort to the bishop's desperate flock. But that should not obscure the fact that it is little more than a piece of helpless mystification, a contradictory cry of optimistic despair. Terrible catastrophes inevitably encourage appeals to God. We who are at present unfairly luckier, whether believers or not, might reflect on the almost invariably uncharitable history of theodicy and on the reality that in this context, no invocation of God beyond a desperate appeal for help makes much theological sense. For either God is punitive and interventionist, the Robertson view, or as capricious as nature and so absent as to be effectively non-existent, the Obama view. Unfortunately, the Bible, which frequently uses God's power over earth and seas as the sign of his majesty and intervening power, supports the first view, and the history of humanity's lonely suffering decisively suggests the second.
That was Annie Laurie Gaylor reading the New York Times op-ed called Between God and a Hard Place, written by James Wood, who's author of the novel The Book Against God, and he's a staff writer at The New Yorker. We'll try to book him for a future show.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor with Dan Barker for Free Thought Radio. Coming up, evolutionist Jerry Coyne, author of Why Evolution is True, and a little more news.
Find out more about Free Thought Radio and the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org or phone 1-800-335-4021. This is Free Thought Radio. As Mark Twain said, Faith is believing what you know ain't so. This is Free Thought Radio.
This is Free Thought Radio. I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor with Dan Barker.
In the news of the week that cannot go without comment on this show was the report in the London Telegraph that a 16-year-old girl who was raped in Bangladesh was given 101 lashes for becoming pregnant during the assault. The girl's father was also fined and warned that the family would be branded outcasts from their village if he didn't pay. According to human rights activists, the girl, who was quickly married after the attack, was divorced weeks later after medical tests revealed she was pregnant. The girl was raped by a 20-year-old villager in Brahmanbaria district in April last year. Bangladesh's Daily Star newspaper reported she was so ashamed following the attack, she didn't lodge a complaint. Her rape emerged after her pregnancy test, and Muslim elders in the village issued a fatwa insisting the girl be kept in isolation until her family agreed to corporal punishment. Her rapist was pardoned by the elders. She told the newspaper the rapist had spoiled her life. "I want justice," she said.
And so this gives us a chance to point out that this Muslim justice is actually right out of the Old Testament, and in conformity with it. Christianity, Judaism, and the Islam religion share the Old Testament, many of its same teachings, the same Abrahamic root, of course. So what looks to us like this terrible barbarism, even to many fundamentalist and believing Christians in this nation, for instance, is actually endorsed by their holy book.
And you, Annie Laurie, you wrote a book, a guide to Bible sexism, called Woe to the Women, The Bible Tells Me So, which, of course, is available from our website, ffrf.org. And what does your book say about the Bible and rape?
Well, first, it's the longest chapter, I think, in my book, because the Bible teaches that women are male property, buyable, saleable, abductable, and rapeable. And there are just innumerable passages dealing with women as the booty of war and commanding rape as part of the duty of a soldier. And there are many cruel passages which lay out the Bible's scorched earth policy of utterly destroying everyone during slaughters. But usually there's this postscript, "Well, keep all the women children that have not known a man by line with him alive for yourselves."
All the young virgins.
I'm quoting numbers, but there are many other cold-blooded passages, and there are many wartime rape orders, such as that the city shall be taken and the houses rifled and the women ravished.
So God ordered rape. A wartime rape is endorsed by the Bible. What's the connection between the Old Testament, the Jewish Hebrew scriptures, and the Bangladeshi rape victim being lashed 101 times?
Well, in Deuteronomy, that's where the Bible lays out some of it, the Mosaic Law, referring to rape and also seduction, and there's a thin line between them in the Bible. And for example, the Bible says if a virgin woman is engaged and a man find her in the city and lie with her, she shall be stoned to death, because the assumption is that she didn't cry out. The Bible assumes a rape couldn't really happen without someone hearing and stopping it in the city. It doesn't make a lot of sense. But in this case, the woman and the man are both stoned to death. And he's stoned to death because he has humbled his neighbor's wife.
So rape is really a property crime then.
Mm-hmm, against a man. And then the rape law about the fields, when they talk about the city and then they talk about the fields. If a man finds a betrothed damsel in the field and forces her and lies with her, then the man only shall die, because the Bible says she cried out and there was none to save her. But even if the Bible doesn't really discuss in general terms the rape of an unbetrothed woman, it only really cares about women as property. There is a little distinction between the seduction and rape if she's not engaged. If an unengaged woman is raped, the man is supposed to marry her. So the Bible's idea of charity and justice towards such rape victims is to force them to marry their rapist. But getting back to the Bangladesh barbarism, in Leviticus 19:20-22, the Bible says, Whosoever lieth carnally with a woman that is a bondmaid, betrothed to a husband, she shall be scourged. She shall be scourged.
Scourged, that's like lashing, right?
Yes, and the sin which he hath done shall be forgiven him. So there you have it. That's what happened to that Bangladeshi teenager, straight out of the Bible. Now, of course, many Islamist nations have evolved equally barbaric additional laws about rape. Some of them insist, for example, that the rape victim has to produce several male eyewitnesses if she comes forward to report a rape, or else she'll be jailed and worse. But those of us reading about this case in America today should bear in mind that if we in this country went back to that old-time religion and we really lived under biblical edicts, as the fundamentals would like us to, that women rape victims would be treated much the same as this Bangladeshi teenager is being treated under Islamist sway.
Which is why around our office, around our foundation, we don't call the Bible a good book.
No, it's a good book to keep out of our government, and it is one of the reasons that we work hard to keep religion out of government. You should know your enemy.
I'm Dan Barker with Annie Laurie Gaylor for Free Thought Radio. Coming up, evolutionist Jerry Coyne to talk about his new book, Why Evolution is True.
Hi, my name is André Lachance. I'm from Thorndale, Ontario, and I'm on Free Thought Radio.
Protect the First Amendment. It protects you. This is Free Thought Radio.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor with Dan Barker for Free Thought Radio.
And our guest today on the phone from Chicago is Jerry Coyne. He's the author of the book Why Evolution is True, which came out last year, 2009, and just this week has come out in paperback. Jerry Coyne, and spelled C-O-Y-N-E, Jerry Coyne, is a professor in the Department of Ecology and Evolution at the University of Chicago, where he specializes in evolutionary genetics. He focuses on the origin of new species, using especially Drosophila. Do you know what that is, Annie Laurie? Drosophila?
It's the fruit fly.
It's the fruit fly as a model organism. He's a former student of the distinguished Harvard geologist Richard Lewontin. Coyne has taught evolutionary biology for more than 25 years and contributed to the public debate concerning evolution and creationism. He's published widely in many journals. He's the author of Speciation, which is a textbook with Alan Orr. It's now the standard academic text in the subject. He was elected fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences in 2007. So welcome to Free Thought Radio, Professor Coyne.
Thanks a lot.
I really enjoy your book. I was reading Dawkins' book, a new book, last year, and he said last year, of course, the 200th birthday of Darwin was a great year for new books, and he especially pointed out your book, which he praised highly, and I can see why after having read it. So thanks for writing such a great overview and introduction to evolution.
Thanks. I should point out that Richard has a new book out on the evidence for evolution as well, called The Greatest Show on Earth.
We're going to talk to him next week about that book. So
great.
Yeah, wonderful book. So I noticed that in your career you have been not just proposing and teaching evolution, but you've also been combating intelligent design and creationism.
That's right. I've been doing that almost ever since I took up the cudgels as an evolutionary biologist. It's almost inevitable. So.
Well, good for you. So I saw one of the articles you wrote in The New Republic, which is The Faith That Dare Not Speak Its Name. And after rereading that article, it looks a little bit like the same format as your book. Your book is a nice medium-sized book, which is a great introduction for people who don't know much about evolution. Why did you write this medium-sized book?
Well, I guess two reasons. The most obvious is to give, Americans the evidence that they need to both understand evolution and to realize that it's far more than just a theory, as it's often called, as Ronald Reagan called it, that it's actually a scientific fact, but also to allow people to combat creationism more easily. They'll have the facts at hand and see how they're able to dispel the notion that the Earth was created with all species present. So it's sort of a handbook for people that want to learn about evolution but also want to fight creationism.
Well, what struck me with the title is that you even have to use a title like that, Why Evolution is True. It's a great title, but doesn't that say a lot about where our country's at right now?
Yeah, it's kind of a sad situation. I mean, it's like saying why atoms are true. Nobody writes books like that. Or
why gravity.
Disease, why gravity works, why diseases are caused by germs. I mean, all these things are, called theories, the germ theory of disease, the atomic theory, but, the scientific meaning of the word theory is something that's a fairly well-established explanation for natural phenomena. So, evolution is on the same grounding as gravity and atoms and disease-causing microorganisms, but of course, Americans don't buy it. I mean, virtually every American would say, yes, atoms exist, but only about half of them will accept the fact of evolution. And that's sort of a sad commentary on the scientific state of our country.
Well, you know, there's a branch of academics called music theory. Mm-hmm. And so should somebody write a book, Why Music Is True?
Yeah.
You know, does that mean music doesn't exist because it's just a theory?
Well, I mean, it wouldn't be necessary, of course, for me to write this book if there weren't a large segment of the American public that doubted evolution, and I think that's largely for religious reasons. And there's no other reason to explain why evolution is so controversial when there's as much evidence supporting it as the existence of atoms.
So if you were, confronted with a non-thinking creationist, but who's asking you questions about, well, why should they believe evolution is true, what would you say?
I'd say for the same reason that they believe that that viruses cause AIDS or that flu is caused by viruses, that's what the evidence says.
Say sin causes AIDS.
Well, I mean, I think the vast majority of Americans, when they get ill, go to the doctor and expect that the remedies that they give for the disease, like antibiotics, are going to work. So we have sort of an instinctive deference to authority and also acceptance of facts, but somehow that doesn't extend to evolution, where everybody thinks they're, an expert on the topic, even when they don't know anything about the evidence.
You have 9 chapters. What is evolution is the first, and then you have one on fossils. I really like chapter 3, remnants, vestiges, embryos, and bad design. How is bad design a proof of evolution?
Well, that's a good question. That's one that theologians always ask. When I give examples of bad design, like the appendix in humans or certain features of our muscles or nerves that can't be explained by a beneficent, efficiently operating creator, they always say, well, how do you know that God doesn't work that way? But my answer to that is that these designs are completely comprehensible by evolution, and they're not predicted under any sort of creationist theory at all. So it's not just that we say that these things are not understandable by creationism, but also that they're perfectly understandable by the theory of evolution.
That big nerve, I forget what it's called. Goes to the larynx.
The recurrent laryngeal nerve, my favorite example.
I was amazed especially with a giraffe.
In fact, in Richard's book, he talks about that. You want me to explain that?
Yes,
yeah.
Please.
Yeah, so the nerve that innervates our larynx starts in the brain, it's a cranial nerve, and then goes to the larynx, but instead of going directly, and that route is only about a foot if you measure the distance from your brain to your throat, it goes down into the chest, loops around the aorta by the heart, and then comes back up to the throat again. So it actually doubles back and has several extra feet of length. In the giraffe, it does the same thing, except it has to traverse that long neck twice, so it's actually about 15 feet longer than it has to be. Mm-hmm. And that's not only bad design, but it's inefficient because, for example, in humans, if you have blood to the chest, you could be rendered permanently hoarse. So it's just not a good thing to do. And you can say, well, that's bad design, and why would the creator give us all that extra nerve? But evolutionists not only say it's bad design, we have an explanation for it, which is testable. That is that nerve used to be lined up along with the artery when we were fish, and both of them ran to the gills. But the gill vessel moved backwards to become the aorta. The nerve stayed up front because it still had to innervate the larynx, which evolved from the gills. So you have a blood vessel moving backwards and backwards, and the nerve has to keep moving backwards to stay, hooked around it, but nevertheless still go up to the front. So, this long detour is perfectly comprehensible once you know the evolutionary history of our blood vessels and our throat and our nerves, but it makes no sense under the idea that it's designed.
So God has a lot of nerve.
That's pretty good. I haven't heard that one before.
No, you talked about appendix, and there's a vestige. These are always rupturing and causing problems. What about the appendix?
Yeah, that's another one. I mean, we're starting to think now that maybe the appendix does do something, but what it does is maybe harbor some cells that contribute to the immune system. But that contribution is minor compared to the chance of it. I think it's something like 15% of Americans, or maybe it's 1 in 15, get appendicitis. And our ancestors, having an appendix would definitely be a bad thing, regardless of its contribution to the immune system. So it's a maladaptive feature. But again, evolutionists have an explanation. It's the evolutionary descendant of a large pouch in the appendix that a lot of our leaf-eating primate ancestors still have. So we have an evolutionary leftover that's bad for us, and it's still hanging around, which is evidence once again for common ancestry with other mammals and indeed other primates.
No, I don't like to give away. You might have already guessed. I haven't read your book yet, but it's on the top of my list. But let's talk about the embryos that's in this chapter 3. What about embryos?
Well, they give more evidence for evolution. Everybody knows, I think, or at least most people should, that the early human embryo looks just like a fish embryo. It has gill slits, it has a tail, you know, their tail remains with our vertebrae, or the sort of tailbone that we have. And in the fish embryo, that fish-like thing continues to grow and become an adult fish, but in the human, over time, it transforms itself into something very different. So that's one piece of evidence, that we go through stages in our development that are incomprehensible unless we descended from a fish that had an embryo that looked like ours.
And isn't there a word for that, too?
Well, there's a phrase that's meant to sum it up called ontogeny recapitulates.
That's it.
Phylogeny, which means development reiterates the evolutionary history of the species. That's not precisely true in the sense that as we develop, we don't go through step by step our ancestry. Some steps are left out because they just disappear. But it does make the useful point that features in our embryos are comprehensible only if we evolved from an ancestor. One of the most interesting features of, for example, a human embryo is that we develop a thick coat of hair called the lanugo at about 6 months. So every fetus at about 6 months sprouts this coat of fuzz in the womb, and it's shed before birth. It makes no sense at all. It doesn't do anything in there because it's constant temperature. If you look at other primates, like chimpanzees or orangutans, at about the same period of development, they develop the same coat of hair, but they don't get rid of it. It's what they're born with and the fur that they use. So the fact that we develop this transitory feature makes no sense unless we share a common ancestor.
But we kept the goosebumps.
Yeah, well, we have goosebumps, in fact, which is an evolutionary holdover, probably because it's not so costly to produce goosebumps. So when you have, you know, goosebumps are caused by the erection of very small muscles at the base of each hair called the erector pili. And if you look at your cat, for example, if you have a cat, when it gets scared or when it gets cold, its fur fluffs up. And that's because these little muscles contract at the base of each hair. And it's used to make these cats and other mammals look bigger. Your cat will do that when it's frightened or scared or facing an enemy, or when they're cold to provide insulation. So it's useful in our relatives. But goosebumps don't do anything for us because we don't have any hairs really to erect that make us look fearsome or protect us from cold. So it's an evolutionary holdover.
Well, it's like
evidence of evolution.
It's like a footprint. It's like a proof of what our ancestors had.
Right, I call them palimpsests in the book, which refers to those medieval manuscripts that were overwritten because paper and skin was hard to come by, but they can still recover traces of ancient writing by peering, sort of taking x-rays of old manuscripts. And that's what we see in the human body. We carry traces of our ancestry.
Palimpsests, that's a good way to think of it.
Yeah, that's why I call it that in the book. It's probably the best analogy that, you know, if you just look at the body superficially, it looks like humans are a unique new species, but if you look deeper, you see that we actually carry a lot of traces of our ancestry.
Well, we're gonna take a quick break here, but we'll be back. We're talking with Jerry Coyne, author of the book Why Evolution is True. I'm Dan Barker with Annie Laurie Gaylor, and you're listening to Free Thought Radio.
Hi, my name is Mark Moninger from Rancho Cucamonga, California, and I'm on Free Thought Radio.
This is Free Thought Radio with your hosts, Dan Barker and Annie Laurie Gaylor.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor with Dan Barker for Free Thought Radio, and we have on the phone with us Professor Jerry Coyne, author of the book Why Evolution is True. And during the break, Jerry, Professor Coyne, we were briefly talking about your own views on religion. Do you want to share them?
They're not going to be popular with a lot of people. I guess maybe your listeners would be more popular with them. I'm an atheist. I see no evidence for any kind of celestial being or interference of said being in the works of nature or in evolution. So I basically, you know, see no evidence for God. So that's my notion of what an atheist is, and that's what I am. So.
Well, hear, hear. And did you have to work your way out of any religious beliefs?
Well, I was brought up nominally Jewish. I mean, we went to synagogue very rarely. The old joke is, what do you call a Jew who doesn't believe in God? And the answer is a Jew. I was one of those. But I guess I can pinpoint the exact moment when I became an atheist. It was in, I think, I can't remember the year, but I remember it was when the Beatles, Sgt. Pepper came out, and I was sitting on the couch listening to it at my parents' house. And for some reason, I just suddenly realized there wasn't a God. I don't know if the music stimulated that or not.
Maybe it was John Lennon or something.
Yeah, of course, he was a well-known atheist. I started shaking and sweating and got very upset because in 10 minutes I accepted it. So I got over it very quickly.
It's very interesting.
Yeah.
Phenomenon.
And with me being raised in a Christian family and being a preacher and all that, I used to preach against evolution. You know, it was this horrible, evil thing. I was a fundamentalist. But, you know, I didn't really understand it. If I had had a book like yours, it would have been like water in the face. I had this totally weird idea of what evolution was. I thought it was some kind of like internal force but the world needs simple books like yours. It's not overly simple, of course. There's a lot of meat in it. But it needs straightforward books that explain this process. I think it would open a lot more eyes.
Right. Hope so. I mean, I like to think that learning about evolution is more like a warm bath and a cold pail of water in the face. But the fact remains that, you know, a lot of people are resistant to evolution, even when they do learn about it. That's one of the problems that I have to face writing a book like this, is that if you're religiously bound not to accept evolution, then no matter how many facts you're confronted with, you're not going to buy it. And there's a poll in Newsweek, I think, last year in 2009, where they asked Americans, I'm sorry, maybe it was a Gallup poll. They asked Americans, if you were faced with a scientific fact that contradicted one of your religious beliefs, what would you do? And something like 64% of Americans said they'd reject the fact in favor of their faith, which I thought was a pretty appalling statistic.
Yeah, because maybe the scientists are wrong. They don't know everything, right?
Well, it's true. We don't know everything, and we have been wrong before. But evolution is one of those things, like the existence of atoms, that there's been so much evidence over the past 150 years that it's very, very unlikely to be wrong.
Now, I got to tell you, one of the things that would have really impacted me is in your book is called Why Evolution is True. On page 103, there's this picture of the continents before and after. And, today when you look at the continents, there's a lot that doesn't seem to make sense. And yet when you run the clock back, can you explain a little bit about, and Darwin was into that too, biogeography.
Yeah, and in fact, Darwin didn't know about this fact that the continents have actually moved over time. It's called plate tectonic theory. It's another theory, by the way, that happens to be a fact. And so he had to go to great lengths to explain some of these bizarre distributions of plants and animals. For example, the plants of southern South America are very similar to the plants of South Africa. And, you know, it's hard to explain why a creator would put exactly the same kind of plants on different places, but in the intervening areas they wouldn't exist. And now that we know that Africa and South America were connected to each other, up to like 160 million years ago, it makes perfect sense. And there's a lot of facts about the world and the distribution of animals that you can't understand unless you realize that the continents moved. And this is something actually that's been found out in the last 50 or 60 years. So.
And the scratches in the rocks were all pointing willy-nilly, but when you put the puzzle back together, they're all pointing in the radial direction then.
That's right. I mean, when a glacier moves, it makes scratches in the rocks, and you can tell which direction it moves by the way the scratches are. So if you look at sort of glacial rocks and deposits in different continents, they don't make sense. It looks as if the glaciers actually originated in the sea, and we're pushing the ice towards the land, which doesn't make sense because glaciers form on land. But if you actually put the continents together as the way they formed when the glaciers existed, you see that indeed those glaciers were over the South Pole and moved sense, and then the continent spread. So
what was that called? Isn't there Pangaea or what?
Pangaea.
Pangaea.
Yeah, the giant supercontinent.
And when did they start drifting exactly?
I have to do this off the top of my head, but I think it's about, they've been drifting all along. I mean, that's what happened in, you know, when the creation of the Galapagos in Hawaii, and it's what accounts for the earthquake in Haiti. It's the movement.
Yeah.
Giant plates that are moving even now. The continent, the southern continent of Pangaea, started splitting apart about 160 million years ago.
But Robertson doesn't understand that.
Well, he imputes earthquakes to the wrath of God rather than simple plate tectonics.
Well, maybe those ancient fishes made a pact with the devil, and that's...
that's one way of explaining it. I mean, there's a simpler way. You don't have to invoke Theodicy, God punishing Haiti. It's just that Haiti, you know, lies in a fault, and that it's just gets earthquakes as a result of
that. Yeah, and it's not Haiti's fault that it lies on a fault.
Yeah, that's right. I think Christopher Hitchens wrote an article with that sort of pun in it.
Now, you also talk about the falso record, but I think it's interesting that even if we didn't have the falso record, we wouldn't need it. There's so many other lines, and the falso record is like maybe icing on the cake or an actual visual confirmation of what all the facts point to.
Yeah, true. And Darwin himself didn't have any fossils that showed evolution in 1859 because the fossil record wasn't very, you know, complete then. And he is always lamenting how bad it was. But nevertheless, he made a case for evolution that was completely convincing based on other things besides fossils, like the biogeography you just mentioned, embryology, bad design, imperfections in animals and plants, vestigial organs like the appendix, the striking results of artificial selection on plants and animals, which is very similar to natural selection. All these things he adduced in his book, The Origin of Species, 150 years ago. And within 10 years, every biologist that was rational was convinced he was right, even without a single fossil that documented it.
Or comparative genetics like we have today, even.
Yeah, and that's more icing on the cake, stuff that we don't need, but still makes sense only in light of evolution. I mean, our own body, the human genome, for example, which is just uncovered in the last decade, contains dead genes that are functional in our relatives. We have genes in our genome that make egg yolk, but human eggs don't have yolk. Those genes are dead. They were useful in our reptilian and fishy ancestors.
Well, thank you so much, Jerry Coyne. Jerry, your last name is spelled C-O-Y-N-E. Jerry is the author of Why Evolution is True. It just came out in paperback this week.
Thanks
so much for being on our show today.
Cheers.
We also want to thank Brian Tarani, our engineer and producer. Free Thought Radio is recorded in Madison, Wisconsin. Go to ffrf.org/radio to hear archives and podcast.
Ask for more information at ffrf.org or phone 1-800-335-4021. The January-February issue of Free Thought Today is now available. You can ask for a complimentary copy at our website, or you can phone 1-800-335-4021. In our educational work for Free Thought and the separation of church and state, tune in next week for more Rational Radio and Blasphemous Broadcasting.
Free Thought Radio is a production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, ffrf.org. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews brought to you by Annie Laurie Gaylor and Dan Barker.
I hope someday